several problems related to Jungian topology in ideal hydrodynamics of incompressible fluid, and also some problems of Hamiltonian dynamics and group theoretic approach to the KdV equation. Most of KdV will be next lecture, and today I will concentrate on ideal fluids. Essentially, most of the issues that I would like to discuss can be traced back to the original paper by Arnold, published in 1966. So in some sense, this lecture can be taken as a propaganda for that paper. So first of all, which equation we are kind of considering, first of all. So this is the Euler equation of incompressible fluids. Ideal incompressible fluid. We assume that it is filling some manifold or even the simplest case a domain in Rn. And of course, we mostly will concentrate on the case of dimension 3 and sometimes dimension 2. So the equation itself is as follows. It is the equation on a velocity field v, and it says that the time evolution of the velocity of the vector field in domain M plus v dot grad applied to v, so on a manifold, one should think of that this is the covariant derivative of v along v itself. It is given by the gradient of some unknown function. This function can be found uniquely from the condition that actually fluid, which we consider, preserves volumes. In other words, divergence of the vector field v is supposed to be zero everywhere. Also, if we are looking at manifold with boundary, then we assume that our velocity field is tangent to the boundary. Okay, so this is in the case where we have manifold with boundary. Now, so as I mentioned, the function p here, pressure function, is defined uniquely up to a constant by the condition that the field V is divergence free in the initial moment. For instance, this equation allows us to find it in the next moment, and it is again is supposed to be divergence free. So this actually allows us to find this pressure function P uniquely up to a constant. Now, the equation looks a little bit ugly, but just to see its geometric meaning, one needs the following observation. Suppose that we have a flow on, say, in domain M, which is given by a diffeomorphism. So a point x at time t is sent to is given by diffeomorphism g of tx. Probably I should. Okay, just we have a flow of this fluid, and then the definition of the velocity vector field v is that it is the time derivative of the fluid of the flow. Of course, at the initial moment, we start with the identity diffeomorphism. So this is just definition of V, of the flow, if you wish. But now, let's take the second derivative. Let's look at the acceleration of the flow. Then the chain rule immediately gives us that the second derivative in time of G says that we have to differentiate this function v in t, so it will be the time derivative of v plus exactly v dot grad applied to the time derivative of g, which is given exactly by v. So, in other words, the material derivative, how it is called, which is on the left-hand side of our equation, is nothing but the acceleration of particles. We just follow, we just trace particles, and this is what we have on the left. What we have on the right is some gradient vector field. So, okay, probably. Everything depends on t, right? Now, the Euler equation can be rewritten in the following form. It is the acceleration of the flow, which is given by minus gradient of p. Again, here I have to put gradient of g of tx. And essentially, what it tells us that acceleration, that if we look at the space of all possible diffeomorphisms, in other words, of such maps G, then the acceleration of our motion along the space is orthogonal to the space, just because we have gradient of some function and gradients are orthogonal to divergence-free vector fields. All vector fields are divergence-free. So this is exactly the condition of being geodetic. Let me just write it down. So, g of tx is a geodetic on the space of all divergence-free on the space of all volume-preserving diffeomorphisms that we denote by. So this is the space of all volume-preserving diffeomorphisms of the manifold M. So if you just imagine that we are on some huge space of all volume-preserving diffeomorphisms, of course, this is infinite dimensional, and G of Tx is just evolution on that space, then everywhere the acceleration of this evolution is orthogonal to the space of all different fields. So it isn't, it just marks that it is orthogonal, so looking transversal to the tangent plane, right? Yes, yeah, so orthogonal, right, with respect to, okay, let me just, since the acceleration is orthogonal to SD at every point of the curve in the L2 matrix. Now, just a minor remark is that, probably I just mentioned this, actually this metric is not, this L2 metric has an additional property on this space that it respects the group structure that we have on diffeomorphisms. We can multiply them, so they actually form a group. We can multiply diffeomorphisms, compose them, take inverse, and it turns out that this metric is, so to say, right invariant with respect to this action. So that all led admit to the following definition that now is, I will formulate in more general terms. So Arnold's approach to the Euler equation on any Lie group . So far we considered different morphisms and they form a group. We could take, for instance, rotations of a three-dimensional space. They also form a group. So let's consider some Lie group, in other words, some space of transformations which is closed with respect to multiplication and taking inverse. So essentially, we'll be thinking about examples of rigid rotations of a three-dimensional space or the space of all volume presenting different morphisms of a manifold, and consider the space of infinitesimal rotations of different morphisms. They are called Lie algebra, the infinitesimal elements of the group. So this is the Lie algebra. Now we think about Q-symmetric 3x3 matrices for the case of rigid rotations or divergence-free vector fields. So this is divergence-free vector field. So the picture is... Right, so here are examples. So imagine that this is Lie group. Take the identity element and consider the space of infinitesimal elements, which means the corresponding tangent space. This constitutes the Lie algebra. Now, so far, essentially, the only ingredient that we fixed was the Lie group, because Lie algebra is automatically defined. Now, one extra ingredient that we would like to insert into the problem is fixing a metric on this group. We will do it in the following way. We'll fix a quadratic form on the Lie algebra. So we will be able to measure, just define inner product in the corresponding tangent plane. So fix a quadratic form on G, and we'll do it with the help of, so we will call this form the energy. This will be 1/2 of V AV. So we will use some self-adjoint operator A to define such a quadratic form. And this A has to be thought of as, let me probably put a picture here. So we have the tangent plane G. And I would like to think of A as an operator from G to G star. Now, so then we will be able to pair the dual element, so AV will be in the dual space, and we can take its value on V. Now, so this is for some operator A, which is called inertia operator. Any quadratic form will do. No need generate. So after that, we'll do the following. We'll define a, for instance, right invariant metric on the group by just transporting this quadratic form from the identity element. So this was identity element on the group. And now at any point, I have another, so I have a corresponding tangent plane, and I'll just transport this quadratic form from here to the other tangent plane at any point by means of, say, right translation. This way, I will get a right invariant metric on the group. Of course, in the case of an infinite-dimensional space, I would have to take additional care how to define, I mean, in what sense it will be the metric. But let's just for a while forget about infinite-dimensional difficulties. So this way, we just define quadratic form everywhere at any tangent space. It's quadratic form here, right? I mean, I have to have some linear coordinates for that. But the group is curved. So I'm speaking about so quadratic form here, and I pull it back to a tangent space here. Right, right. But I need, but I'm prescribing how I do this. So this will be taken by means of right translation. So from here, for instance, this is the point G. This is identity, and I'll just pull by means of right translation all vectors here and define the corresponding tangent space. No, of course, there is no problem in defining some quadratic form. I just said that this defines a metric. When I'm saying that this is a metric, it is a weak metric in some sense. So everywhere on the group. So the tangent elements, I can measure distances, yeah. So but here I would like just to measure vectors in the corresponding tangent space. No problem. Yeah, you can do this. Yeah, that's the next step.
From the identity to some other point little g. So in order to do that, you have to be able to solve the geodesic equation.
Exactly, yeah.
But that was my lecture yesterday. Sometimes you can, and maybe you can't. If it happens to be the Euler equation. So I think there's some interdimensional subtlety in there.
Now, you would like to say that.
Create geodesic and have to.
Right.
So this is sort of the, if you can, this is what you get.
So in principle, you know that for infinite. But why it exists? I mean, if so, the geodesics can be defined as a minimizer for the least action principle. So, right, but why it exists? Let us say why it is non-zero. Yeah, I mean, it is a metric space. Yeah, so then there are two points at distant points at the. At a zero distance, right? So that's. So now what we'll do, we'll consider geodesics with respect to this metric. So let's look, for instance, at some curve that passes through identity, which is the minimizer in some sense, so geodesic curve gamma. With respect to this metric. And after that, we'll do the following. So, for instance, I consider the geodesic curve, and then I take the velocity vector along with geodesic, and then I pull it back to the identity. Again, with respect to, by means of right translation, with respect to the same translation as I used to define the metric. This way I get a vector at identity, but probably not the one I started with. Actually, I started with some velocity vector, considered geodesic with that initial velocity, and then I just trace the corresponding vector here, the velocity vector along the geodesic, and pull it back. So this way I'll get some dynamical system on the Lie algebra. So instead of considering geodesic flow on the group, I'll just pull everything to the identity, depending on time, right? And then I'll have a dynamical system on the Lie algebra. Exactly this equation is called the Euler equation for an arbitrary Lie group and prescribed inertia operator. So as I, let me just write this down. So Euler equation is the geodesic flow in the corresponding right invariant metric on G. Actually, we could right invariance is just for applications to different morphisms, but for instance, for rigid rotations, for a rigid body equation, we have to consider left invariant metric. So one side is invariant metric, and namely, what I mean by that is that if gamma is a geodesic, then we just pull back its velocity the moment t to the Lie algebra, we obtain some equation given by some nonlinear iterator on vector fields. So this is some nonlinear iterator. And this equation obtained this way from the geodesic flow is called the Euler equation on the Lie algebra. Corresponding to the inertia operator A. So there are two ingredients here, the group and the inertia operator for the metric definition. Now, this looks like a kind of thing. What? Pull back by using the group operation. Once we are here and we know the velocity vector, we just pull this back by means of the right translation. We can forget about the curve. Once we have velocity vector, we just pull this back and we just mark what it is. The velocity vector, of course, is the tangent vector to a geodesic line. That's right. But then we just pull this back by means of right translation, by multiplying it by g. What?
Does it always come out autonomous?
No, it will not be. Wait a second. It's non-local in principle, yeah. It will be autonomous, I believe, right? Because if you have just
change time,
the same answer, right? So generally speaking, it's like it's quadratic, roughly speaking. Like it is here, v appears quadratically there. That's an idea. But the important point is, it is of the first order. Geodesic equation is of the second order, right? When it is written in this form, it is of the second order in T. But we write it on the velocity, on V. And this way it is of the first order on V. So we kind of suppressed one derivative just by writing this on velocity. So that's why it is kind of a dynamical system like this. And the reason for kind of doing this kind of formalism is that there are many examples that actually fall into this picture. So examples, let me just give you some examples. So I'll mark here the group G and sometimes say something about metric or the inertia operator A, and then I'll write here the equation, the corresponding Euler equation. So, for instance, the original example of Arnold was to consider SO3, and then the metric was the metric of a rigid body. Then you'll get exactly the Euler top equation. And then there are extensions of this approach to SON, and with similar metrics, so-called Markov's metric, then it is n-dimensional top. It's interesting to consider, for instance, SO3 semi-direct product is R3. So in other words, all Euclidean motions of three-dimensional space. Then also, by considering something similar, let me not specify the metric here, one gets the Kirchhoff equations. For a rigid body in a fluid. Another example that was considered by Walter last time was if you look at the group of diffeomorphisms of a circle, all of a real line, and consider the L2 metric. In other words, so we have to prescribe some quadratic form on the tangent space at the identity, so the tangent space will consist of vector fields in one dimension because you consider a circle here, and they'll just take the L2 norm. Then the corresponding equation here is the Burgers equation, or sometimes called Hopf equation, in this case, Burgers. So it is V V dot plus V prime, so it is just the same term as here, V prime, equals zero. That generates shock waves. Now, next example that I would like to consider in more detail next time is so-called Virasoro algebra. That is just a one-dimensional extension of diffeomorphisms. So diffeomorphisms of a circle extended by just one parameter. Essentially, think about the diffeomorphism and remember one number. Then the L2 metric here leads to the KdV equation, while other metrics that one can consider on functions on a circle lead to other interesting equations of mathematical physics. For instance, the H1 metric, when you take the integral of V squared plus the integral of V prime squared, leads to Kamasa-Holm equation. This is the result of Missy Olick. One can also consider H1 dot homogeneous metric, which leads to so-called Hunter-Saxton or Haridim equation. So there are interesting examples here, but I'll leave it for the next time. Now, another example of interest for us right now is if we consider the group of volume-preserving diffeomorphisms of a manifold and L2 metric on this group, right invariant L2 metric, then this is exactly the Euler equation for an incompressible flow. Now, this the analogy here is that an analog of SDF is actually three-dimensional rotations. What is an analog of rigid motions of three-dimensional space? Well, we just have to consider the semi-direct product of this group by the corresponding Klee algebra. If one considers L2 metric on this much bigger space, of course, it turns out that this is the main equation of magneto-hydrodynamics. And probably just one more example. So this is so-called self-consistent theory on hydrodynamics and also appears in dynamo theory. And one more example probably is the current group of currents on a circle. If we consider all smooth maps from a circle to, say, SO3 again, and H minus 1 metric, then the corresponding equation is the Landau-Lifshitz equation. So as you see, there are many interesting cases. So all of these systems are conservative systems. Of course, they have the conservation of energy law, and that's why one can consider the corresponding geodesics. You see, the metric is the energy metric, and of course, the velocity vector is preserved along the geodesic, the length. So that's why we are able to put all these pictures into systems into one picture. Of course, if we have some viscosity in the fluid already, this picture doesn't work, or at least should be drastically changed. Now, of course, I would like to emphasize why this group approach is useful. First, would like to concentrate on something that is more related to the original equation than to this approach, and then we'll connect these two pieces together. So, namely, the next section will be the topology of steady flows, or stationary. So, yeah, sometimes it is left, sometimes right, yeah. Roughly speaking, it depends on our agreement, how we multiply operators or diffeomorphisms. So essentially, whatever is connected with diffeomorphisms has right invariance. That's kind of the way. So it's essentially, it starts here. This is right invariant. It's on the right, right? And here it is left invariant. the sign will be different, essentially. There will be a sign, but you see, this is the operator B. I didn't disclose what B is, right? So there will be a sign here. Just remark to that you always can make right translations to the left ones just by considering the conjugate group in some sense, just by redefining all elements. G move to G inverse. And one can just trace then what happens with the Lie algebra here. Essentially, it's just you'll get an extra minus more or less here, and it is roughly quadratic here. That's why there will be an extra minus. Okay, probably it will be clear a little bit later, and you can ask a little bit later, okay? Good. Okay, so now I would like to talk a little bit about stationary flows. Stationary flow means that we consider the solutions to the Euler equation which do not depend on time. In other words, the time derivative of V is supposed to be zero. So just forget about this very first term, and the remaining equation is called stationary Euler equation. Sometimes we call them stationary flows, sometimes steady flows. That's kind of the terminology here. So it just says that essentially that the covariant derivative of V along itself is equal to a gradient of some function. It turns out that this is a rather strong condition on topology of the vector field V, because we also assume that V is divergence free. So it turns out, for instance, that one can rewrite this condition in the following way. So I will be mostly interested in the three-dimensional vector field. This can be rewritten as follows. V cross product with curl of V equals to the gradient of another function, which is essentially the pressure up plus the square norm of the velocity vector field. So in, for instance, on a three-dimensional manifold, here alpha. And let me probably give you one more. Here, just the notation. So alpha is called the Bernoulli function. And one more way to rewrite this is that the commutator of V and curl of V is identically zero in M. Just one more way to rewrite this equation. Just take curl, essentially, of both parts. Okay, so this is the commutator in the sense of vector fields. Now, a very important observation is that from this equation, from this form, we immediately conclude that velocity field V is always tangent to alpha levels, to the levels of this function alpha, right? Because the vector product is given by the gradient. It means that V should be orthogonal to this gradient, and thus it is parallel to its level. So V is always tangent to alpha levels. In other words, alpha is the first integral for the dynamical system defined by V. You see, just for free, just by looking at this equation, we realize that there is a first integral to this equation. But one can say much more, and this was one of our nice theorems. That for a closed three-dimensional manifold M without boundary, all non-critical levels of alpha are toric. If you just think a little bit about that, I'll say a few words a little bit later. It just means that essentially stationary three-dimensional flow looks like a system with 2 degrees of freedom, is an integrable Hamiltonian system with 2 degrees of freedom, because it lies in a three-dimensional manifold. One can imagine, say, Hamiltonian system with 2 degrees of freedom. It is in four-dimensional symplectic space. If we restrict it to a level of the energy function, for instance, it will be a three-dimensional manifold, and now it is polarized by toric. So the same happens here. I'll explain this. Yeah, I'm going to explain actually this, because the proof is very simple and beautiful. And even more, one can say that there is the R2 action by the fields V and curl of V. And for a manifold with boundary, alpha levels, non-critical alpha levels are either toric or annuli. Moreover, the flow lines on toric are periodic or quasi-periodic, and on annuli they all are periodic. On two toric. Lines are closed on annuli. So let me kind of prove this briefly, just keeping all the details. Well, what does it mean that alpha level is non-critical? This means that the gradient is non-zero, right, on that level. And this implies that V is non-zero on this level, and moreover, it is tangent to that. So we have a two-dimensional surface, so it is a non-critical level, so it is a closed two-dimensional surface if it is a closed manifold. Then the alpha level, so alpha level is an orientable two-dimensional surface, so just surface. For which there exists a tangent vector field, which is no way zero. This means that it must be of Euler characteristic zero, hence it must be a torus. Similarly, one can show that if alpha level, if you have manifolded boundary, then just the same story applies, but again we have non-zero vector field which is tangent to that, so it must be an annulus. For a surface with boundary. Alpha levels are. So if this level set touches on the boundary, it must be anyway. So the picture apparently should be something like that in the boundary case. But it's Euler characteristic must be zero, just because Euler characteristic is the index of a vector field on a surface. You have a vector field on a two-dimensional surface, right? And the Euler characteristic, I claim that the Euler characteristic of such a surface is zero, because one of ways to calculate this Euler characteristic is to take the sum of indices of a vector field. Sum of indices of a vector field. So the Euler characteristic of alpha level should be equal to the sum of indices of a vector field, for instance, V. Any vector field will do, but I will take V. Indices are taken at zeros of V. Exactly. Then it must be torus, yeah. Right. Yeah, in particular. Yeah, so since it is non-critical, then delta alpha is non-zero, and then immediately just by looking at this equation, we see that C must be non-zero. Right? I mean, if the right-hand side is non-zero, then both contributors in the left-hand side must be non-zero. That again might be tori. That's possible. That might not. Yeah. No, not. So actually, the theorem itself is more subtle, and it actually says the following: that if we have the analytical case, so the manifold itself is analytic, if the vector field is analytic, then the claim is that if there exists the splitting of this manifold into a finite number of cells, each of which is affiliated by tori or annuli. So you have the finiteness for free just from analyticity of the problem. I just swept it under the carpet. We just say that whatever we have non-critical is affiliated into tori and annuli. The affiliation to annuli looks approximately like this one, can you imagine? So now we touch on the boundary. So all levels like here are affiliated into a closed curve, right? So these are alpha levels that I wrote here. So these are just annuli. But if we had, so this is M and this is the boundary of M. But if M were without boundary, then this would be just a torus. Each of them would be a torus. Now, okay, so the first remark that I, so remarks. So first, if we have an analytic data, then we have finite number of cells, as I said. Uh, Under cell, I mean the cell which is late affiliated into tori or annuli. Next is that we actually have the R2 action, because on each of the non-critical levels, we have both V and curl V non-zero, and moreover, in one of the interpretations here, they commute. So we have actually two vector fields, two non-zero vector fields which commute. So we have the R2 action on this level, and in particular, that's another way to see that this is a torus, right? So we have R2 action on tori by V and curl V, commuting vector fields. And that's why, in particular, one can introduce the coordinates, like x angle action coordinates there. Probably I'll just erase this. So, in particular, there are coordinates phi1, phi2, and the one which leads tori, such that the alpha levels are just given by constant V, and V is V1. Is coordinate depending on V, D over D phi1 plus V2 of V, D over D phi2, and similarly for curl V. So it is similar to an integrable system, as I said. Now, it's another peculiar thing is what happens if the gradient of alpha is zero. So this all was under the assumption that we have indeed some non-trivial first integral right here. But it can happen that alpha is just a constant. So this is another remark. Let me call this, okay, that's 1, 2, and this will be 3. So if alpha is identically constant, so all levels are critical, then we'll have, then V cross curl V is identically zero. So in other words, this means that the vector field V and its curl, its vorticity, how it is called in hydrodynamics, they are collinear at every point. Such fields are called force-free fields. If V is nowhere zero, then we can rewrite curl V as the scope of the function times V. So it is just proportional to V, where kappa is some smooth function. And now, another observation is that in this case, kappa itself is the first integral, to our equation, dynamical system V. So then kappa is a smooth first integral indeed. I'll just write the following identity. Let's take curl of V and take its divergence. We know that curl of V always has zero divergence. On the other hand, one can rewrite this as divergence of kappa V, which in turn is just the gradient of kappa inner product with V. So it means that V is, again, the tangent to the levels of kappa. So you see, in this particular case, for instance, again, we have such a funny situation. And again, all the kappa levels are tori, just because we have under the assumption that V is non-zero, we have, again, a tangent vector field. And we don't have R2 action on this tori. We just have R action because curl might be zero somewhere. Now, another interesting case is this kappa is actually a constant, not a function. In this case, curl of V is just proportional to V itself, not only collinear, but just proportional. So in other words, such a field V is an eigenfield for the curl operator. Now we do not, in the later case, there exists no first integral, and indeed the corresponding fields can exhibit rather complicated topology. One of the examples of such fields are so-called the ABC flows that stimulated a lot of studies lately. So let me just mention this. If curl of V is lambda V, so in other words, as I said, V is just other eigenfield, an eigenfield for the curl operator, then it is a more complicated topology of V. Such fields are called Beltrami fields. And the example of those are so-called ABC flows on a three-dimensional torus that are given by the formulas that the x component of the field V is A sine Z plus C cosine Y. The Y component is B sine X plus A cosine Z, and the Z component is C sine Y plus B times cosine X. So apparently they are called ABC flows because of these coefficients that we used to define them in the original paper. Sometimes people decipher this as Arnold Beltrami Childress flows. Anyway. And finally, I would like to make a remark about two-dimensional version of the same theorem. In dimension two, V is, again, an area-preserving field, so it is a Hamiltonian field. It is probably multi-valued Hamiltonian. In other words, usually it is defined with help of a so-called stream function. In the Hamiltonian language, it is just the Hamiltonian of the corresponding field. So V is skew gradient of some function psi. So psi is called stream function in hydrodynamical terminology. And then the condition that V is a stationary flow or steady flow means that the the field. So what does it mean that we say commute with the corresponding curl? In this language, it means that the gradient, the function p, the stream function, and its Laplacian have the same levels. So in other words, the corresponding gradients are just collinear. Or I write this, that if I take the Laplacian of the stream function, it is some unknown function of the function p. So again, or I could say that p and Laplacian of p have the same level curves. For instance, you have a complicated function c in a neighborhood. So, of course, Laplacian can have different values at the same levels, but you have the same level, so that the gradients of them would be just collinear at every point. Okay? In principle, yes, but kind of it's difficult kind of to prescribe this. It's rather a priori. We have some stationary solution, and then we'll see what kind of relations they satisfy.
I could try to reverse it if I can solve the equation.
Yeah, if you could, yeah, it's true. Let me just finish this by saying that the same very equations, either of them that I mentioned here, I like most V cross curl V equals to gradient, but say V commutes with its curl, also not bad. So there are variational principles which lead to this equation as the equation of extremals, and I just would like to mention them. They play an important role in hydrodynamics and magnetohydrodynamics, in both of them. So variational principles. For steady flows. So the first, so there are two principles. One of them, usually one is called the MHD principle. That steady flows are extremal fields, extremal flows, extremal points for the energy functional, for the L2 energy functional, if we minimize the energy among all fields that are diffeomorphic to a given one. Okay, so let me just write this down. So steady flows are extremal. For the energy, the L2 energy functional among all divergence free vector fields diffeomorphic to a given one. So one should think that all fields kind of affiliated by leaves of diffeomorphic fields, and now you can restrict the energy to one of such leaves, and then the extremals of this restriction will exactly correspond to the steady flows. Okay, that's one of the principles. And B is kind of the dual one. It's called the ideal hydrodynamics principle, which says that the steady flows are extremal fields for the same functional, but just one word will be different here. Instead of diffeomorphic, which was the for the MHD case, So I'll just put here that it is the same story. But for all divergence three vector fields, whose curl, okay, so all divergence three vector fields, whose curl is diffeomorphic to the curl of the given field. To a given curl. So then the foliation is different, but we consider still the same functional. For those, okay, so in some sense, for those familiar with this terminology that I will use next time, the diffeomorphic fields, they correspond to adjoint orbits in the Lie algebra, and the fields corresponding to the, how they are called, isovertex fields, the fields with the diffeomorphic curls, they are coadjoint orbits in the corresponding dual space. So the claim is essentially that the energy functional has the same stationary points in the Lie algebra and in the dual space, on the adjoint orbits and on coadjoint orbits. They all are related by means of the inertia iterator. That's it.